stuff near art that is not art, which is treated as if it were art, is now the substance of most serious art. And I would argue furthermore that this condition is directly a result of the practice of art and language within the contemporary art world. This statement offers a concise, although admittedly enigmatic, description of what I take to be the situation of art after art and language, or what we might also call post-contemporary art. I've heard this term bandied about recently, post-contemporary. We say, now, if you make contemporary art, you are behind the times. You need to make post-contemporary art. So, though I should say, this statement argues that much of the important art produced today, and you know, we could spend a long time arguing about what makes work important or serious or not so important or not so serious. This art that's made today is typically made out of material situations, atmospheres, and attitudes that had not earlier been considered to be meaningful parts of one's potential experience of the art object. Now, before I go any further and actually discuss these potentially post-contemporary manifestations, I should say that much of the work I will mention in the next several minutes could be related to what I would call the modernist impulse within what might be called art after art and language. So I'll sketch in the entire history of art in the next 5 minutes. So that'll be fun for you. That is, perhaps we could say the conventions of visual representation were repeatedly challenged and renewed throughout the era of modern art, from Manet to Cézanne to Malevich to Jackson Pollock. Similarly, one might also say that art after art and language returns to the challenging and renewing of artistic form that was typical of modern art. But art after art and language does not work on the conventions of representation any longer. Instead, it works on the conventions of reception and distribution that have historically conditioned our acceptance or non-acceptance of visual art. To put it extremely bluntly, modern art is a story of artists producing representations that become increasingly difficult to understand through reference to our shared experience of the world. I think we'll stipulate that that seems to be true, but I'll say more about it. These artworks force the viewer to accept an ever more challenging, problematic, or pick your adjective here, representational vocabulary up to and including a point where the word representation itself becomes very difficult to use at all. I'll put it extremely bluntly again. I could show you virtually any image of a work of art from 1850, and you would be able to understand what it depicts. Literally. Turner might be an exception, but it's a rare exception. While I could show you easily hundreds, if not thousands, of images that are in textbooks and catalogs from, say, 1950, and you would not have any idea what they depict. In other words, artists cease to accept the conventions of depiction and representation that had dominated the production of Western art, and that is the story of modern art. Functionally, everything I've just said is a preamble to my more fundamental opening question. What happened to this modernist impulse that I've been talking about, this orientation towards the intense questioning of form after modernism supposedly disappeared? My answer is that modernism did not disappear. It transformed itself in its most persuasive form into an art practice that is called art and language. Now, I'll give you even more quick art history. So this is the history of late 20th century art in two slides. I would argue that somewhere between Andy Warhol's soup cans first appearing on the Ferris Gallery's walls in 1962 in Los Angeles and the demolition of the gigantic Pruitt-Igoe public housing complex in St. Louis in 1972, two events that have come to signal the eclipse of modernist ambition in painting and architecture, something happened that none of us really expected. What happened was the pedagogical and exhibitionary framing around modern art, everything that seemed irrelevant, gradually began to be transformed into the unlikely source for modernism's subterranean elaboration in our current post-contemporary art world. Now, that last phrase probably does not mean a whole lot to you right this second, so I'll try to sketch it in as quickly as I can. So we could say that modernism never vanished during the postmodern era of Damien Hirst, Jeff Koons, and Cindy Sherman. It simply ceased to be visible as art because its manifestations began to emerge in odd places, at odd times, in odd forms, and often in the work of an odd collaborative project called Art and Language. I would go on to argue that over the last 40 years, Art and Language has produced an extremely complex body of work, which in some sense has made possible the very notion of something being post-contemporary. And these works belong, that is the Art and Language works, belong to the trajectory of modernism, even if they are not precisely modern art in a chronological historical sense. So in other words, I think we could describe Art and Language's work as a whole as modernism after modern art. So art historically, perhaps we can say that modernism began to discover sustenance in various locales in the 1960s, and Art and Language is one of them. But I would like to push this point a bit further because I think it's important to understand an alternate view of art of the last 40 years. And it's an alternate view that I think is implicit in Art and Language's practice. So I apologize. And you'll notice I'm not showing you any images by Art and Language, but luckily we just looked at quite a few. So I find that edifying. It must be emphasized that many artists of the 1960s acted as if they were historians of modern art. In fact, many actually were art history students. Donald Judd, Dan Flavin, Robert Morris. However, few commentators have deduced the larger and crucial symmetry that is at work here. One must also remember that some of the most important historians of modern art, for example, the editors of the standard textbook these days for 20th century art, Art Since 1900, they were all deeply committed to imagining themselves to be involved in the production of art at various different points in their lives. Benjamin Buchlow and Rosalind Krauss both in their youth, intended to become visual artists. And Yves Lambois spent much of his youth in the company of artists and involved in art projects. So if several important artists of the 1960s became, so to speak, postmodern art historians who produced problematic objects and challenging experiential situations for the art viewer, then one will find a curiosity here, the more carefully one looks. It is similarly true, though inversely, that critical art historians during the same era increasingly began to act like modernist artists. But instead of producing hard-to-decipher canvases and interventions and all of the dialectical mishmash that Art and Language produced, they produced discursive interventions that questioned our agreed-upon assumptions about the conventions of viewing modern art. So in other words, to point out the obvious. In a very real sense, making someone see a Jackson Pollock completely differently is very close to producing a Jackson Pollock of one's own. It's just that you don't use paint and a canvas, which was no longer viable. You now use lectures and writings. And so I'd push this point even further. We may even eventually realize that these historians of modern art were mobilizing the history of modern art itself as a kind of artistic medium, a kind of continuation and expansion of modernism by other means. On this score, the journal October, which has been edited by Buchlow, Bois, and Krauss for several decades, has championed practices that weirdly correspond to the activities of historians of modern art. The more closely you look, it's really striking. Whoa, that's not right. You have Hans Hacke investigating provenance records. Marcel Broters is out curating art exhibitions. Dan Graham is publishing materials in art magazines. James Coleman is sequencing slideshows. Andrea Fraser is giving gallery talks. And Michael Asher is printing art catalogs. These are all activities that one associates primarily with the work done by those who write about art, not those who create art. And it is one of Charles Harrison's many remarkable discoveries that he discovered this before anyone and acted on it. In other words, in my opinion, art and language was in fact the first practice that began to combine the artist historian and the historian artist in one problematic whole. And let me emphasize the word problematic. If you combined it in one synthetic whole, I think that would be incredibly difficult. It would be not difficult, it would be incredibly problematic in a very different way. Thus, the professional discursive framing that had once allowed us to rapidly, almost automatically distinguish art from its non-art surroundings has been transformed irretrievably. And today, a mobile cloud of evaluative anxiety has engulfed art and language, an evaluative cloud of anxiety that is not that different, I would argue, from the cloud of anxiety that temporarily obscured the achievement of Manet, Cézanne, Malevich, and Pollock. So once museum guards and audio tours and publicity departments and PowerPoint presentations and press conferences become active players in the production of art experience, then one inevitably wonders about the framing around virtually all art and its supposedly non-art surroundings. In other words, simply put, we owe the very viability of such gestures in a very real way, for good or bad, to art and language. Thus, if in 1917, Duchamp could present a urinal as a work of art in a space reserved for artworks and thereby provoke a contentious discussion concerning the character of the artwork, I think art and language has achieved a similar effect over time by inverting the formula. Art and language frequently presents their art as something that viewers should not consider a work of art as they are looking at it, often in a space that has not been reserved for the interpretation of art. That is, modernism's self-reflexive skepticism toward its own capacity to accurately represent the world, its focus on the problematic status of the artist and her artistic authority and skill, modernism's fascination with anti-commercial modes of being in the world, and its concentration on the problematic character of describing any work of art, all of that and all of these concerns attached to it have reemerged, I would say, with great vigor in the work of art and language. And so, in a very basic way, the art world lives in the wake of art and language, even though I don't think it realizes it.